Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KVOO.fm.
KVOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KVOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kvoo.fm. KVOO's Board of Directors meets on Monday, December 19th at 6 p.m. This month's board meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found at our website at kvoo.fm.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll speak with an Iranian woman who's a member of the Feminists for Jina Network and a professor in social sciences. We'll discuss the ongoing protests inside Iran that have the power to upend the theocratic government under the slogan of Woman, Life, Freedom. Then Nathan Robinson, editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine, joins me for a lively discussion about artificial intelligence and the AI software that's taking social media by storm. We'll talk about its implications for abuse and its potential for learning and for reducing work. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Protests in Iran are going strong, coalescing around a simple demand captured in the words Zan Zindagi Azadi, which translates into woman, life, freedom. The massive movement was triggered by the mid-September death of a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini in police custody. Amini had been jailed for reportedly flouting Iran's strict dress code for women. Now, as Iran's government is facing its most serious crisis of legitimacy to date, there are reports of a potential dissolution of the so-called morality police. Meanwhile, the government has been executing protesters and threatening others with executions as well. We turn now to an Iranian feminist activist who is asked to remain anonymous. She's a member of the Feminists for Jina Network, and she's also a professor in social sciences. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, for those who have who need a refresher, remind us about Mahsa Amini, who she was, how she is known, and why her death, which has not been the first death in such a situation, but why her death has sparked this movement.
Yes. Yeah, so Mahsa Jina Amini, so Mahsa is actually her state-sanctioned name. Her real and her Kurdish name is Jina. She's a Kurdish woman from the city of Saqis in Kurdistan region of Iran. She died, as you mentioned, in police custody in mid-September. And her funeral was really the day that marked the spark of these massive revolutionary uprising. What happened on that day was Well, first, on her gravestone, her family inscribed very prophetically, Gina, you won't die. Your name will become a symbol of resistance. And on that day, in her funeral, women take off their scarves. Scarf is mandatory under Shia Sharia law in Iran. So there is a forced mandatory hijab. So women take off their scarves in an act of defiance, waved in the sky, in the air, and chanted Jen Jian Azadi, which is a Kurdish slogan with a long history in Kurdish liberation movement outside of the Iranian Kurdistan. And that's really the event of that day started to spread to the city of Sakdes, other parts of Kurdistan, and then throughout Iran and internationally for Iranians in diaspora.
So right now, it's been several months that we've had protests, and we've seen chapters of protest in the last few decades before. Is this different from earlier, revolutions as they've been seen, the Green Revolution and other movements sparked by deaths?
Yes, I think this is a very important question and perhaps an issue that a lot of analysts and scholars are thinking about. And it does definitely feel different, and it is very different from the previous protests. We know that, as you mentioned, within the past decade and before that, Iran has seen, different periods of these movements. But the one thing that is very different here is that it is led by women. It has a feminist demand as its core, but it's not, it cannot be reduced to just bodily autonomy. It is in fact more than that. It's really asks for the overhaul or toppling of Iranian regime. And people basically want to live in a society that is no longer governed by Islamic Republic. Another thing that is very different about this uprising is the presence at the forefront of this movement of ethnic minorities, Kurdish people, Baluchi people, who've been under years of discrimination, intersectional discrimination, and it seems like all of these people are coming together from different identities. Even beliefs, ideas are coming together and chanting Jen Jian Azadi, or woman, life, freedom, something that's been reverberating with a lot of people from different groups, different classes, different communities. And I think it is a much more inclusive movement than what we have previously seen.
So tell me about Feminists for Gina and how activists like yourself are working in solidarity with those inside Iran.
Yes. There are a lot of collectives that has been formed ad hoc following the death, the murder of Gina Amini and the uprising that ensued. Feminists for Gina is a network of women and queer people who identify as feminists and have come together ad hoc to organize in solidarity with the Women, Life, Freedom movement in Iran. But I think what's perhaps unique about Feminists for Gina is one of its values is transnational feminism, and in order to achieve that, we're trying to build solidarity with different feminist movements in the region and around the world, and we're eager to hear from them, make connections, build solidarity, and fight our common fights, and we are trying to highlight and echo the more progressive feminist voices that are coming from Iran, and to you know, to hear also what they're hearing, just sort of be a link between these movements.
What is the demand now? A few months into this movement, initially it was, you know, very much centered on women's right to just be, to not have their dress code policed. But I imagine it's a lot broader than that now, right?
For sure. That's thank you so much for asking, because I see a tendency in Western media to reduce the demands. I mean, I think even using the word demand might not be very accurate, but to reduce these protests to, you know, the dismantling of a mandatory hijab. I think it's way more than that. It's about everything that Jinjian Azadi, woman, life, freedom, I think encompasses, is at odds with the irredeemable existence of Islamic Republic. And so what woman, life, freedom means, and I mean, it means it is negating the whole Islamic Republic. And I really think that people in Iran do not want a reform. They want a revolution. They want to have and live in a different society that has a different, you know, political system. And I know regime change is a lot of time confused with foreign intervention. And I do not think that is what people in Iran want. And what we feminists who are standing in solidarity with Iranian people want, we want grassroots, people-driven, radical change that truly brings women, life, freedom. And so it should not be confused with foreign attempts at intervening.
What about the role of men inside Iran? The protesters, some of whom have been executed, are men, not just women.
Yes, for sure. And we should be clear, when we say a feminist revolution, it is by no means, you know, exclusive sort of label. It is, in fact, trying to bring up feminist values that are at the foundation of this uprising, that men alike have been an ally and fought with their you know, friends and sisters and families along, and, you know, whoever is not, I guess, a heterosexual cis man. They've also fought with them, and they're paying the price for it. So when we say a feminist movement, what we mean is an imagining of a society that is a radically feminist, that is built around solidarity, communion, and not competition and class differences. I think, and some that actually empowers women, queer, just like men. So that's what we mean by feminist uprising or feminist solidarity. And I think for the most part, a lot of men have, you know, been an ally and supportive in calling it a feminist revolution. There might be some hesitation, of course. You know, there are a lot of people coming together to build this movement. But I think at the end of the day, the content of this revolution, this uprising, whatever you want to call it, is way more progressive than anything that we have seen. And we do see a large number of people coming. And of course, the executions, there were two men who got executed, right? And we acknowledge that and understand that.
There's also, I understand, a professional soccer player, Iranian soccer player named Amir Nasser Azadani, who's now facing execution in Iran. And this is, you know, the World Cup is happening, so there's a lot of people who are paying attention to soccer in general. And so there's a lot of international attention placed on this. Iran is not looking very good in the eyes of the world, is it?
No, not at all. And I feel like we see a change of tone and how, you know, in how Iran is being perceived and described. But of course, it's not enough. I think there's still a lot of disinformation and misinformation coming from the Iranian government and their supporters or their mercenaries, if you will, inside or outside of Iran. And I think what's important is to listen, pay attention, and not to fall for this information that's been propagating. For instance, this issue that morality police is being dismantled, and we see a lot of attention being paid to that, while in the background there are people being hanged. I mean, it's sometimes unbelievable to imagine, but the death penalty is carried out by hanging people in Iran, and Tumen just been hanged. So when you pay attention, you see that this information that is coming out.
And I want to also bring up the fact that Iran is, of course, the government has faced opposition from the United States, and I'm wondering how you feel about some on the left who are critiquing this movement by saying, well, this has been, you know, organized by the National Endowment for Democracy. This is a U.S. government-sponsored movement. Of course, it benefits the U.S. when Iran is destabilized from within. I mean, they may not support the theocratic government in Iran, but you do hear, unfortunately, a vocal minority on the left who are not Iranian, who ascribe what's happening inside Iran to Western-backed efforts to destabilize the country.
Yes, that is very unfortunate. That was a reality I have to face, you know, being an academic and being in a lot of left-wing circles, both academics, but also activists, non-Iranians, who feel like this, who see a very surface level, I think, interpretation of this movement, who have a very surface level interpretation of this movement, which is, it seems like, very much just directed by opposition to right-wing policies and politics. As a group or as someone who cares about justice, about feminism, about freedom, you know, leftists should care about this issue, should pay attention, should not fall into making this false dichotomy of, you know, it's either it's a U.S. intervention or Islamic Republic. You know,
this, I think the U.S. may take advantage of on-the-ground movements, but that doesn't negate the on-the-ground movement.
Yes, for sure. And there is always, you know, whenever you're fighting for democracy, even there are Iranian opportunists or, you know, people who support right-wing, you know, policies and politics, who are also, like, you know, in support of this movement. But to reduce the courageous fight of people for freedom, for liberty, for women, for life, which are all very progressive values. You can argue they're leftist values, as a right-wing propaganda or U.S. intervention, I think is honestly disrespectful to the people who are fighting. And I think I ask our leftist allies to try to turn the lens, and instead of looking through the event through a reactionary politics to right-wing, you know, ideologies in the U.S. and, you know, in the West, but actually to the people on the ground in the global South who are, you know, resisting and fighting for.
I mean, it would be as if Iran dismissed the Black Lives Matter movement here in the United States and the social and the uprising, the racial justice uprising in 2020, as a way to destabilize the United States from within. What about the current situation? Now, I mentioned there are reports that there may be a dissolution of the morality police. There were some reports that sounded more definitive, and then it turned out that some of these reports were rumors. What do you know about, well, first of all, who the morality police are and whether or not the government is actually committed to reforming or completely dissolving them?
Yeah, I think just to finish on the previous point, I think what you said was very an interesting illustrative example. It's as if to say, I mean, you know, the supreme leader, in fact, likes to talk about, you know, supreme leader likes to talk about racial injustices, which are very true and very real, about racism, the criminal justice system in the U.S., talk about Black Lives Matter. Should we say that, okay, we should dismiss this whole movement because a dictator is, you know, professing support for it? So I think the argument could go other way too. People.
So I was just using it in a hypothetical, but you're saying that this this is actually a thing that the Iranian
theocratic
leaders. They say, look how terrible the U.S. is because of Black Lives Matter movement.
So discourses of anti-racism, the pro-Palestine liberation movement has been co-opted by the Islamic Republic for the years. But that does not make us, you know, that should not, you know, prevent us from still believing and fighting for those values. Your question about the what the morality police is and what's the current state of it. So morality police is just an organ of this big militia and paramilitia forces that Islamic Republic has as its disposal. Their job is to monitor and control people on the streets, particularly women, anyone who's not dressing in the way or behaving in the way that they're supposed to behave. So if you are not wearing the hijab properly, you can be stopped, you can be taken into a detention center, you can be interrogated for hours. And, you know, we know what, as was the case, unfortunately, with Gina Amini. I mean, she died. But the morality police, it basically has this, you know, its responsibilities to regulate people's social lives in public. And if you're not following the gender norms and gender rules that are imposed by Islamic Republic, you could get into trouble with them. As whether it has been dismissed or not, honestly, the news of its dismissal, I think, was just something suggested, or basically idea that it this the morality police was, you know, dismantled was, I think, was just like a commentary or a suggestion by an official that was being made. But where I see most of this being getting coverage was like in New York Times and some other media sources here outside of Iran. I have since haven't heard about getting rid of morality police from the officials. I haven't read anywhere. The only thing we've been hearing, who are closely watching the events that are happening, is just sheer brutality in cracking down protesters, torturing them, abducting them, sentencing them to death penalty. And so I do not see any sort of concession from the regime.
So they've dug in their heels, and it seems as though are appearing to want to try to ride out the movement. Are there any signs that the movement is petering out, or is it just gaining strength? And can you also speak to the solidarity, not just from the Iranian diaspora, but the non-Iranians around the country who are inspired, who are holding protests and rallies in support? So two-pronged question. Is it slowing down inside Iran? And what's the role of the solidarity movement?
Sure. I think to answer the question whether it's slowing down or not, we have to understand that it is a process. It is a revolutionary uprising, and revolutions, movements, unfold over a period of time. They go through their ups and downs, especially in ultra-oppressive contexts. So when you think about it in this light, I think it's pretty much alive and going. The sense of anger, solidarity, and hope is pushing people forward to, you know, resist, engage in civil disobedience, take it to the streets, and other, you know, creative ways that people have been, you know, showing their opposition to the Islamic Republic. So I think, as we're speaking, because the news of the execution of the second protester who's been executed just came out, I think people are organizing to respond to that. So we're in the sense of dealing with this news, digesting and organizing for it. So from afar, it might look like, you know, it's going through an downhill, but I think it's just a natural, organic part of this movement. There's going to be organizing, there's going to be more quiet days, there are going to be days where there is more protests happening. But I should say, ever since this protest has started, which is now it's entering into its third month, every day has been some form of protest, civil disobedience, and action. So, and you must understand that anyone who engages in this is really risking their lives. So I think there is still a lot of momentum in this, but the regime is also brutal and they are not yielding. And I don't think they will yield ever. And to answer your second question, I think it is very interesting. On the one hand, I see a lot of solidarity as working with Feminist Virginia, you know, connecting with other feminist groups, queer activists, Kurd activists, Kurdish American activists, a prison abolitionist in the U.S. You see a lot of solidarity, and it's beautiful, and I think it has a potential for creating a movement that goes beyond the borders of Iran. But on the other hand, I think the mainstream view and public opinion, you know, on this is, you know, very, I don't see as much solidarity. I don't see as much that you might expect. So I think there are two sides from it, but the potential is there. And I know that there are a lot of collectives, activists, feminists, both inside and outside of Iran, who are trying to make these connections, who are trying to join a more inclusive fight with their allies outside that were not Iranian. Yeah.
You mentioned that you don't think that the government will ever relent. So then what? What do you think can happen? Where does this end?
I think perhaps this question, I mean, of course, we think about it a lot, but I think the answer is, it's not a static answer. Like, the visionary is not static. The imagination for we have this peaceful, as much as we can, transition from Islamic Republic to a regime that is chosen by the people for the people. I think this imaginary is changing. You know, I think we should just wait and see how this is. It's very, I think, from, of course, and especially for someone who's outside of Iran, it's hard to make these predictions about what will happen. But something is different, that's for sure.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you, and appreciate your spending this time with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My guest has chosen to remain anonymous. She is a member of the Feminists for Jina Network, whose members work anonymously as a collective, and a professor in social sciences. And we've been talking about the ongoing protests in Iran, women life freedom protests. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. Thank you. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. You may have recently noticed friends on social media posting cartoon likenesses of themselves in various fantastical formats. They didn't commission digital artists to create those renditions. They generated images through a free trial of a new artificial intelligence or AI digital art program called Lensa. Lensa is just the latest program in a wave of AI art software. Other programs include DALL-E and Stable Diffusion that generate imagery based on descriptive text entered by the user. There's even a print version of such software called ChatGPT that writes essays based on keywords. Not surprisingly, the technology has sparked a raging debate about how it exploits existing artists' work and has the potential to displace the need for human artists altogether. My guest is Nathan Robinson, editor-in-chief and art director, as well as lead graphic designer at Current Affairs, former columnist for The Guardian, author of Why You Should Be a Socialist. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, The Nation, and elsewhere. And he's written about the implications of AI and is also leading a workshop on this technology in January. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Hey, nice to be with you.
So I notice on social media, you've been having a lot of fun with the AI software, and I've done a little bit of the same just to, you know, out of curiosity, gone and gotten a trial membership at DALL-E and seen what sorts of images you can generate using keywords. And it's kind of fascinating. Before we get into the debate part of it, the part that's controversial, tell me how this sort of software works.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a technical explanation that's very complicated, but then there's the sort of basic conceptual explanation that's pretty simple, which is that essentially it's examining many, many, many different kinds of images and kind of trying to distill them down to an essence, mathematical essence, and so that when you enter in a term, if you enter into the term airplane and you ask for a picture of an airplane, it looks at all the airplanes it has seen before and it has distilled down what the form of an airplane is, and it will show you an airplane. Now, it won't show you a picture of an airplane like from Google Image Search that is an existing picture of an airplane. It will generate from its understanding of what the form of an airplane is a new airplane. Now, if you enter an oil painting of an airplane, it will take its understanding of what the aesthetic of an oil painting is, and it will apply that to its understanding of what the form of an airplane is. And the result can be quite astonishing, because you will get something that looks like a very detailed oil painting of an airplane that has never been done before, that nobody has actually, you know, painted in oil paint. So that's essentially what it's doing, right? It's associating visual cues with the words that you're putting in, having absorbed many, many thousands or millions of image oil paintings and airplanes and everything else under the sun.
So because there are certain artists who have, well, every artist has their own distinct style. We know of some very famous artists. Tell me about your experimentation with, say, the style of Diego Rivera's work, very famous Mexican artist, arguably the most famous, perhaps only eclipsed by his wife, Frida Kahlo. But tell me about what happens when you put in certain keywords and ask it to create it in the style of a Diego Rivera painting. And audience, I'll show some examples.
This is what's truly astonishing. And this is the part that where I really started to get surprised by the level of the capabilities that it had, right? So if I enter, for example, a painting of a postal worker, it will show me a painting of a postal worker. You know, if I enter a painting of a postal worker in the style of Diego Rivera, or a Diego Rivera mural, it will spit out something that I have to say, and I think a lot of observers would also say, looks quite a lot like it's in the style of Diego Rivera. Now, it hasn't been painted by him. He may never have painted a picture of a postal worker. He did, but this is not one of those. This is a wholly new one. And when you start to combine, you know, whatever the wildest things you can think of, you know, I did a Diego Rivera mural of Winston Churchill eating a baby. Just because it was the first thing that popped out, just a surreal, bizarre image, you know, never existed before. I don't think anyone's ever thought, what if Winston Churchill was eating a baby? And sure enough, I have to say, it spits out a bunch of results, and some of them are just weird looking. A few of them look an awful lot like what you think it might have looked like if Diego Rivera had painted a mural of Winston Churchill eating a baby. So the images that come out of these things, when you put in the weirdest prompts you can imagine and these kind of styles. Now, you could say a painting that Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo collaborated on, and it will sort of merge their two styles based on its understanding of what the essence of each of their styles is. And oftentimes when you do that, when you combine, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and Salvador Dali, you will get something that when it comes out does not look, you know, ugly, does not look horrifying. Sometimes it does, but sometimes you think to yourself, my God, that's kind of what I think it would look like if Salvador Dali and Leonardo da Vinci had collaborated on a painting.
And I noticed that you do like the idea of visualizing Winston Churchill eating a baby. You've done that.
I did a few of these.
So clearly, it's a lot of fun. I mentioned Lenza. A lot of the you know, people on Facebook and Instagram are testing it out. Pictures of themselves and putting it out. The Lenza in particular is noticed, I don't know how much you've studied it or looked at it, but there have been some problems, especially women have noticed that you'll find that this program will take the likeness of women and sexualize them, including images of very young girls. Yeah. And this is quite problematic. But what does that say to you about AI and what AI? I mean, there's no, it's not a person doing this.
No, there are so many problems with it. So I have to say my first reaction was, ooh, this is really fun. This is really exciting. But there are an immense number of ethical issues that arise. One problem is that some of these have filters on them. Some of them don't have filters on them. And people can create, you know, truly horrifying and disturbing things with no limits, you know, the worst things people can imagine. Then there's also the fact that what it's essentially doing is it's distilling the essence of images and aesthetics and styles out of examining all of these millions of input images. And so if you put in a bunch of sexist representations of women and then you ask it to draw a woman, it's going to spit out something that is, you know, similar to what it was fed. Then, of course, there's the property rights question, which is that with Lenza, it's not, you know, I have fun with old artists. I have fun with Michelangelo and Salvador Dali and people who are dead, people who've been dead for a while. But, you know, Lenza is making art that looks very contemporary, and it's making art that in many cases is drawing from and synthesizing and regurgitating the styles that have been developed by contemporary living artists who have not consented to have their works fed in to an AI image generator.
So this is the problem. Now, you run a magazine. I imagine as a low budget, you know, outlet that certainly doesn't look low budget, but independent outlets and independent media institutions like Current Affairs, like the ones that I've worked for, are always struggling with money. We tend to not have much of an art budget. And this is also true for some corporate media outlets that are trying to scrimp and save wherever they can. What's to stop them from just basically firing the artists or just stop hiring the freelance artists they might be hiring now and using the software to generate imagery and visualizations for stories?
Well, there, for one thing, it is the case that we have not yet gotten to the point where human designers and artists can, in fact, be fully replaced, because oftentimes the things that the thing spits out require a lot of photoshopping and editing work in order to be, the AI is still putting, you know, people with 9 fingers on one hand and that sort of thing. Well, the main thing that is stopping, though, any organization from using this to cut labor costs is what type of organization is it? So I imagine there's going to be a very, very serious problem with for-profit corporations looking at this kind of technology and going, oh, good, we can automate our art and design work. And I think there is going to be a massive cataclysm where a lot of artists and designers suffer, and the work of 5 people is reduced down to the one person whose job it is to fix up and clean up and polish the computer-generated images. Now, at a magazine like Current Affairs, we're not for profit, so we're not constantly having to look at our bottom line. For us, this sort of thing just expands our possibilities. We are going to keep the art budget for human artists the same, and we're going to hire the same number of people, but they can do more work with new tools. And so all it means for us is that our magazine is going to get better and that more wonderful art is going to appear in it, because we are not a for-profit company, so we don't have any financial incentive to reduce the amount that we spend on human labor. If our artists that we pay start using new tools to generate more and more complicated art faster, we're not going to say, you know, none of our artists may use AI image generating tools in creating things for the magazine. I hope they do, and I hope they use these tools in order to create more wonderful things than they've ever created before.
Nathan, isn't it true that the way in which these AI programs generate, say, for example, something that mimics the work of Diego Rivera is by actually analyzing original pieces, and that they've scraped through the internet millions and millions of existing digital art that has either already been digitized or that was created as digital art, which means that it is using the work of real life artists in order to generate new art, and it's doing so without compensating them. It's doing so without their consent.
Yeah, no, it's true. And there's a major issue. Now, I think it's complicated because, of course, an artist themselves can look at as many images as they want and synthesize someone's style and paint in the same style. There's nothing to stop you or I from looking at a bunch of Diego Rivera pictures and painting something in the style of Diego Rivera. The problem is that what we are seeing happen to a lot of artists is that the image generator, who these are living artists, I don't think that there's any need to or moral obligation to respect the rights of people who are deceased. But for living artists, there are people whose entire work without their consent has been fed into an image generator, and now anyone can generate an image in their style. There's this guy, Greg Rutkowski, who appears, he does kind of Dungeons and Dragons characters, and he does them very well. And he appears in all these prompts. He's never agreed to have his work scraped and used, and all these people are making imitation Greg Rutkowskis without poor Greg Rutkowski getting any money from a style that he has clearly developed. So I think in the case of living artists whose names are being used in prompts, I think there is a real serious issue where they are suffering financially even as other people benefit from their work.
Right. So there's also the issue of what is art? I mean, we can get real deep here. There was the controversy around an artist who generated an AI piece and won a contest competing with artists who basically did the work themselves. He argued that he made it very clear. He was upfront about the fact that this was an AI-generated piece and that it was his creative use of the prompts that created this piece. That was what won him the prize. And we really have to sort of think about, well, does one then need any sort of artistic training in order to do this sort of art or just have a way with words?
Well, you know, what's excited me so much is that I am a writer. I have illustrated a couple of books very badly, and this is a thing that allows writers to almost become artists. You know, the better you are at describing something with the precise words, the more you're going to get what you want. So for writers like myself, this is a wonderful kind of tool, and it does in fact require some creativity. People get very, very creative with the prompt. So it's not that the people who are generating images are putting no work or creativity into it. There was this debate. There was a big New York Times article about this guy winning this contest. He says he's an artist. You know, whether he is an artist, I think, is up for dispute. Is the artist the person who actually, you know, creates the work, or is the artist, can, you know, there are major artists who have entire studios where all of their assistants put together the actual work, and they are the artists who just slaps their name on it. This is kind of just a high-tech version of that in some ways. I, no matter how many images I generate, never ever would think of calling myself an artist. It seems so arrogant when you didn't actually do any of the work of doing the drawing or painting, and all you did was write something. I'm a writer who's able to generate images with a tool. Now, the people who ran that contest, the fact is, if they didn't want AI-generated imagery in the contest, they should have prohibited it. They didn't, and as he says, he was honest about it. I think if he'd been dishonest, there would have been more of an issue with what he did. I think the real people that the artist should be mad at are the people who ran the contest and pitted the human artists up against the machine. I mean, there should be separate categories for those two things. Did you art done by hand, and then art, if you want to call it art, images generated by machines?
There's also writing. So as a writer, you may not feel threatened by visual art generating AI software, but what about ones that actually generate writing? Tell me about ChatGPT, which you've also written about, and which the title of your story very provocatively was Let ChatGPT Convert You to Socialism.
Yes. ChatGPT is a chatbot that OpenAI, who are the people who make DALL-E, have put out. And it's a massive advance on any chatbot, any interactive text generating software that has ever come before. You may have noticed that Siri and Alexa, as good as they are still pretty stupid. They get a lot of things wrong. They're often very frustrating. ChatGPT is on the next level, where you can ask it very, very complicated things, and it will have pretty good answers. Everyone should try it out to see what I mean, and come up with the wildest things that you can. I said, can you write a King James Bible verse about how to eat pears without making a mess? Just the first thing that popped up out of my head. And the fact is, The gosh darn thing put out in seconds an amazing imitation Bible verse that was about how to eat pears without making a mess. I put it in that article. And so, you know, writers too are now a lot of people who write for a living may see this thing. Again, it's on the next level. We thought that only very, very simple writing could be automated, but oftentimes what ChatGPT is putting out is very, very complex, and it's answering questions that involve sort of logical reasoning. It's not just Googling something and spitting the Wikipedia entry back to you.
I imagine that one place where, at least until these programs get more sophisticated, one place that we might see this sort of program being misused is the college essay or even the high school essay.
Yeah. Yes. No, that's right. And teachers have been saying, oh my gosh, this is the death of homework. Because the fact is that you can see with ChatGPT that if you... a lot of things that are sort of basic homework questions, it excels at the 5-paragraph essay, right? It's just brilliant at writing these automatically, because a 5-paragraph essay is kind of formulaic, and it's very, very good at following formulas. And so, yes, if you were to be handed a ChatGPT essay and an essay by a student, you may not know the difference. I've asked it to write essays comparing the works of two philosophers, not even, you know, that commonly known of philosophers, and it's written things that would get, I don't know, a B+, A-. So, but the thing is that you can also see that if for example, two students turn in pretty similar sounding essays that sound a lot like ChatGPT essays, you could go and ask ChatGPT, hey, did you write this? And ChatGPT could not only be used for generating essays, but can also be used to check that essays haven't been written by ChatGPT. So there are sort of ways we can imagine getting around this. At the same time, it does make cheating a lot easier, but it's also an incredible, incredible tutor because it patiently answers all of people's questions on any subject under the sun. It can teach you physics if you just spend an afternoon sitting asking it questions about physics.
Wow. And how can it convert you to a socialist?
Well, what I found is that it's really good at the thing that I spend a lot of my time doing, which is, you know, helping us think through politics and political arguments really clearly. So I asked it, you know, can you explain what some of the problems with like Ben Shapiro's reasoning are? And it explained pretty well with some examples. And, you know, that title is kind of cheeky because I asked it to write a utopian story set in a socialist society, and it wrote a pretty good one, I have to say. Now, you could also ask it the opposite, although ChatGPT does appear to have somewhat left-leaning politics from people who have administered the political quiz to ChatGPT. But I did find that it was very effective at producing arguments, the kind of arguments that I make all the time for why someone, as the title of my book is, why you should be a socialist.
So where do you think this technology is going to go? I mean, if we had had this conversation about whether AI can replace artists and writers a few years ago, it would have really seemed like in the realm of the fantastical. Mm. But here we are, even though these tools are flawed and clearly clunky so far, they are apparently well on their way to fulfilling, you know, these sort of dystopian versions of a future where robots replace humans. You know, I imagine they're only going to get more sophisticated. Well, it's only a matter of time before you can train these programs to make sure every human form has five fingers and not nine, right?
I know, yeah. It seems like a pretty simple problem to solve. And you think, well, when you realize that ChatGPT came out a couple of weeks ago and this is how good the technology is in its infancy, and you think, well, how good will it be once it's actually trained more based on the responses and develops further in, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years? You say the word dystopia, that's one possibility. Another possibility, of course, is that we can use these kinds of tools to eliminate labor we find unpleasant while still doing whatever work we actually enjoy doing. So for the major problem facing artists is that if they make their living from doing art and they train for 10 years on how to do something and then something comes along that does the same thing in 2 seconds that takes them a month, there's a very serious problem facing them in terms of finding a livelihood, making a living. So the dystopian aspect of it really is that people's ability to survive is linked to the value of their skills in a marketplace. And if this kind of technology radically adjusts the values of those skills and reduces the financial value of this, not the intrinsic value, but the financial, then a lot of people are going to face serious trouble in their lives. Now, if we can use these technologies, if we can have an economy that provides for everyone where people don't have to feel threatened by technology, then labor saving can be good. The fact that an artist who doesn't want to have to draw all the hairs on a human arm can just tell the computer, hey, can you draw the hairs? You know, there are plenty of artists who might like to see aspects of the more tedious aspects of their jobs able to be done by a computer, the same way that Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator have really, really helped artists to make incredible things faster. So I think this can be a dystopian technology. It can also be technologies that really help a lot of people. There have been applications of ChatGPT to help people who struggle with literacy, who struggle to write coherently, to, you know, to enter in their thoughts and have it help them articulate themselves in a way that meets professional norms and can help them get along in the workplace. So there are a lot of applications of this that are profoundly liberating and equalizing.
I imagine that one way to protect against the harmful effects going forward is to figure out tests for what's generated by AI and what's not, because, you know, there's a huge problem of disinformation in our society as well. So-called deep fakes that are used to manipulate people and their emotions. But if we have a technology that helps us discern, oh, this was machine generated versus this was real, that could help us go a long way. This was written by a computer and this was written by a human, et cetera, right?
Yeah, one of the real scary dystopian possibilities is, as you mentioned, these deep fakes, the ability to feed in as many, you know, a few photos of someone and then generate new photos of a real person. That's what Lensa has been doing. You know, it's been doing that to the people who want their photos to be manipulated. But what happens when it's possible to create a video of someone without their consent, with their voice fed in so that it sounds exactly like their voice? Google has managed to make it so that we can auto-generate text that is in people's voices. If it recorded a few minutes of me speaking, you could produce anything, any text in my voice, indistinguishable from my actual human speaking voice. When that is developed, and when that is combined with the ability to develop images and videos that can fool people, we have a situation where it's going to be easier than ever to generate fakes, to generate forgeries and fraud. And we already have this terrible problem of misinformation and fake news. So as you say, it's going to be crucial to the safe deployment of this technology in society to have some way of verifying the origins of anything you see to determine what's real and what's not.
Right. And, you know, we certainly can't say that we're going to simply boycott these things out of existence. Every technology that comes about has potential downsides, and figuring out ways in which they can be used constructively seems to be the best way forward. On that note, tell us about the workshop you're holding for artists and for others, for writers and others, in January on how to use some of this AI software.
Yeah. So this is going to be January 7th. People can sign up on Eventbrite if they go to my Twitter, at Nathan J. Robinson. There's a link on there. And it's going to be 3 hours or so, and I'm going to go through, explain, you know, how these things work, how to use them. We're going to discuss a lot of the ethical issues and how to use these things ethically. You know, I think it's very wrong to, for example, generate fake Greg Rutkowski images and then start selling them. You know, and we're going to discuss a lot of the things that we've started to talk about here, the social implications. But I'm also going to show people it's not actually easy necessarily to figure out how to get what you want out of these things. As I say, you've got to be a writer. You got to learn how to, they're a tool, but they don't respond in the way that you necessarily think they're going to respond. You have to fine tune what you're asking from them. But I think if you spend some time with them, you can have a ton of fun. You know, there is an innocent application of these technologies, which is just to generate things that surprise you. They can stimulate your creativity by putting things together in new ways that you wouldn't have thought of to do. And so we're going to be looking at how they work, what you can do with them. We're going to talk about the chatbots as well. So it's going to be a very practical kind of hands-on workshop, but it's not going to shy away from confronting the social and ethical issues with the technology and how we can navigate that.
We'll post a link to the workshop as well as your website and current affairs on our website as well. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us and good luck to you.
Hey, thank you very much.
My guest has been Nathan Robinson, editor-in-chief, art director, and lead graphic designer at Current Affairs, former columnist for The Guardian, author of Why You Should Be a Socialist. His work has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic, The Nation, and elsewhere. And he's written about the implications of artificial intelligence software. He's also leading a workshop on the technology. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and streaming on web at kboo.fm.